From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. COVID-19 cases continue to soar across America and around the world. A number of countries had managed to bend the curve and achieve what felt like a new normal. But now, in places like Australia, Japan, Hong Kong, Spain, countries that seem to represent the gold standard of how to respond, infection rates are on the rise again. So what are we learning about how to respond to this latest phase of the pandemic? This hour on Point, the global surge of COVID-19 cases and how to move forward. With us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Bill Hanage is a professor of epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's also a faculty member at the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard. And Professor Hanage, welcome back to On Point. It's always great to have you.
It's good to be with you, Anthony, but I wish there wasn't so much for us to talk about.
I couldn't agree with you more. Well, let's just sort of characterize what we are talking about. Are we, in fact, in a new phase of the pandemic? Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yes, I think it is a fair way to describe it. We have seen the initial surges in a number of places, and we're now getting to a point when there's suddenly a much larger amount of transmission which is occurring in different parts of the world, and we're reaching the point where we're past the first surge, and we're trying to get ourselves used to the next stage.
When we talk about a new phase or a new surge, I mean, what's really striking is that I think in the early going, we were expecting another surge in the fall as the weather became colder in our part of the world anyway, and we approached a new flu season. But here we are facing a new surge not even at the end of the summer. It's quite striking.
Well, I think that the fact that people were thinking we were going to be seeing a new surge in the fall largely reflects a mistaken analogy with influenza, because influenza has very strong seasonal forcing. So it goes away a lot in the summer and then comes back in the fall and the winter. Now, I think that the last time I was on here, I think I probably said that I didn't expect it to be so strong for this. And unfortunately, it turns out that scientists who were saying that were right. This disease does manage to transmit fairly successfully within the summer months. It's hard to know how much of that is due to perhaps different behavioral patterns. Like across the South, people are more likely to gather indoors because of the fact of air conditioning, because it's really hot outside. But it's certainly true that we are seeing transmission right now, and we can expect to see more transmission going forward.
And I want to talk a little bit about what we're seeing elsewhere in the world. And I'm just looking at a quick roundup here from a recent piece in the New York Times. Australia's new daily cases have increased 11-fold in the last month. Japan and Hong Kong, both hailed as models of infection control, also experiencing flare-ups. I mentioned Japan. So some examples there. You can also look at countries like Spain that had really managed to bend the curve dramatically. They're going back up. What is happening? Is this as simple as they did a great job bending the curve and then loosened up restrictions, and as to be expected, infection rates are going up because of that?
Pretty much, although I would take the examples you've had and, separate them out a little bit. Japan has managed so far to avoid any kind of really damaging surge for reasons which are not particularly clear. It's had a very different trajectory and has been modulated by the government putting in and releasing restrictions every now and then. But the virus has a remorseless logic of its own. On the other hand, Australia and Hong Kong have really so far to date seen very, very, very few cases and have not really experienced a serious surge. Spain, on the other hand, Spain had a big one. Spain really did need to bend the curve. And, you can see this in the per capita mortality statistics. But the upshot of it is that this virus, it doesn't take a lot for this virus to start transmitting again. And so you really have to be on top of your game to stop it.
And what does that mean? Does that mean just maintaining these shutdowns? Because, for instance, I was in touch with a good friend who went through the shutdown in Spain, and they were incredibly serious and incredibly strict about it. But now things have loosened up. Is that an indication that that was just a mistake to loosen things up as they did, when they did?
I think it's an indicator that people were thinking about this the wrong way. There was a very widespread belief that you'd put a shutdown and you wait for it and you wait for it to pass. And this was kind of exacerbated by some of the rhetoric about waves. You know, you wait for the wave to pass you in the ocean. And that's not what's happening here. I mean, the reduction in disease cases was not because of anything other than what we were doing, which was the shutdown. So the important thing to do was, rather than have the shutdown and then reopen, it was to have the shutdown and then work out which parts of a shutdown are most effective and figure out ways to maintain them while also maintaining as much of the economy as possible. I must say, I find the whole talk about reopening profoundly depressing, because it's much more sensible and much more honest to talk about pandemic management. What you're going to do is there's going to be a certain amount of transmission, a certain amount of sickness, and yes, a certain amount of death. You have to decide what you're comfortable with, explain that to your people, and then figure out how you're going to achieve it.
Interesting. Interesting. So let me talk about a case really close to home. You're in Cambridge. I'm in Boston right now. Massachusetts is one of the states that really was at the epicenter of the pandemic back in March. Governor Charlie Baker seemed to take it incredibly seriously. The state was shut down. Now we're in the process of a gradual reopening, a cautious reopening, but there are indeed indications of a rise in infection rates. What does something like that tell you? Does that mean, in terms of managing this pandemic, that we ought to be reversing course? Because a lot of parts of the world and a lot of states are dealing with this kind of, you know, two steps forward, one step back situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a fairly realistic description of what happens. There is one step forward, two steps back. We have to accept that in the face of a global pandemic of an unfamiliar virus, we're going to make mistakes. That's fine. I mean, we make mistakes, we learn from them, we go forward. Now, if you can manage to get community transmission low enough that you can effectively manage to limit it using the sort of testing and tracing that has been seen in some parts of the world which have been doing this very well, I'll point to Taiwan, I'll point out South Korea. I mean, the fact that you'll get outbreaks there doesn't mean that overall they're not being pretty successful at keeping their economies going with comparatively minimal disruption. If you can get it as low as that, then that's something to be aiming for. As it is, you know, the state of Massachusetts has, in my view, actually done really pretty well so far in terms of managing to bring it under control and then maintain it at a level which is being scrutinized carefully in order to figure out whether or not there is going to be an uptick. Mm. It looks to me as if there has been an uptick, and it's going to be very interesting to see what the governor does in response.
Mm. And what's the metric, the key metric that the governor or that any governor should be paying attention to? Is it the number of infections, the infection rate, or what is the key metric?
Well, personally, I'd say you look at a number of metrics, but there are also some that you must not look at. Don't look at hospitalizations. Hospitalizations are a disastrous metric to be following because of the fact that you're actually seeing events which happened sometime in the past, because it takes a while for people to get sick. Cases which are being identified in real time is helpful, but that reflects the intensity and the nature of testing. We don't have we have passive surveillance in most places, which is people coming up and presenting themselves saying, I'm feeling unwell, I need a COVID test, or I'm going to be traveling, I need a COVID test. Whereas an active surveillance thing would be actually looking to see whether or not there's a, whether or not you can go out into the community, take a sample and test them. One of the things which has been happening around here is that there's been some interesting data coming out from monitoring sewage, because people do shed coronavirus via what I will delicately call that route. And you can detect it in sewage. You can just do the test, the PCR test, in order to determine that it's there. And so looking at the amounts of virus in sewage over time may give a pretty good indicator. But I would never look at one indicator alone, because of the fact that if you keep your ear to the ground, you can get a much better picture of what's going on by integrating a bunch of key indicators.
Listeners, we're talking about this next phase, this current next phase of the pandemic. What do you make? What are you seeing? What are you seeing in your state or your community? Are there lessons from overseas as we talk about what has worked and what has not worked overseas? You can reach out to us on social media, on Twitter or on Facebook at On Point Radio, and we will respond to you. You mentioned, Dr. Hanage, Taiwan and South Korea as particularly good examples. What are they doing that is working so well?
They took fairly strong action, fairly firm action, fairly early on. They recognized that there was likely to be a virus with the capability of very great deal of community spread. And, you know, if you let it go far enough, it would cause a lot of sickness and a lot of death. And they put in place a great deal of testing. They put in place a response early in the pandemic rather than a very reactive one. One of the things we've seen here is that we kind of let it come here. We didn't test. We probably allowed it to build up a large amount of community transmission in younger age groups. I think that's a common feature of what we're seeing around the world, actually. It starts in the younger age groups, and then we start to really see it as it moves into the older age groups who are more vulnerable. And the consequence of this is that, I mean, it will continue to be reintroduced to those places. But I want to give a couple of examples from other places that you've mentioned.
Sure.
I mean, one of the things which I think it's reasonable to say if you're talking about the United States is that it's a big country. I mean, yes, the United States is a massive country, and it's very difficult to come up with something which will work on a country that size. But let's look at Australia, which is the closest comparison I can think of. Obviously, way smaller population, but a substantially, you know, and an island, but then substantial number of people coming into it. You mentioned that Australia is seeing surges of infections now, and it's true. However, if you take the key metric, which is the number of people who have died per million population, this is the per capita mortality. It's the one that the president was misinterpreting in the Axios interview a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. In Australia, that statistic is 10 people per million have died of the virus so far. The equivalent statistic for the United States is close to 500 per million. Mm-hmm. So those are deaths that have happened over the last 6 months. And, you know, we are, you know, Australia is 6 months closer to a vaccine, just like we are 6 months closer to a vaccine, but at what cost?
Wow. Okay. We're talking to Professor Bill Hannage of Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health about the global surge in COVID-19 cases, what that might be teaching us as we chart a path forward here in the United States where cases continue to soar. Stay with us. A lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about the state of the COVID-19 pandemic and the recent global surge in cases. We're joined by Dr. Bill Hannage, professor of epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And Dr. Hannage, I want to play a little tape. Last month in a virtual chat hosted by Stanford University, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease specialist, talked about how to navigate the pandemic in the absence of a vaccine.
If you physically separate people to the point of not allowing the virus to transmit, and the only way to do that is by draconian means of essentially shutting down a country, we know that we can do that if we shut down. The Europeans have done it. People in Asia have done it. We did not shut down entirely, and that's the reason why when we went up, we started to come down, and then we plateaued at a level that was really quite high, about 20,000 infections a day.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci. And Dr. Hannage, I mean, I think what stands out in that statement by Dr. Fauci, we did not shut down entirely, and that's the reason why we went up. That idea of just not shutting down entirely, is he right about that? Does that suggest some kind of corrective course of action?
Well, I think it's certainly true that you can shut down more. I mean, I always find it very interesting. I really dislike the word lockdown because it has these kind of punitive connotations. But if you compare what happened in Italy with what happened in Massachusetts, then I remember seeing news reports saying that Italy was reopening or relaxing its lockdown, allowing restaurants to do takeout and people to go more than 200 meters from their house. Well, you know, restaurants have been doing takeout and people have been going more than 200 meters from their house in Massachusetts throughout this. Yeah. So lockdowns are not all the same. You could have done more. But the crucial thing is confusion reigned over why lockdowns were in place if you hadn't yet experienced a surge in disease. That is the point at which you should put in place your testing and tracing, the way to chase this thing, catch it, and then throw it off your shorts to get exclude it from your community. You needed lockdowns in the Northeast in order to prevent that damaging surge into healthcare, but the rest of the country could have been preparing. And unfortunately, we didn't.
I'm glad you mentioned Italy. We're going to spend a little time talking about Italy later in the show with reporter Silvia Pagioli. But so I'm going to sort of put that aside for a moment. But Dr. Hennage, you mentioned testing and the importance of testing. Where are we in that? Because that's another sort of confusing moment. You mentioned that Axios interview with President Trump, and he's claiming that we are leading the world in testing, and also making the statement that the numbers are so high here because we're doing so much testing. Can you truth squad that a little bit and give us the sort of truth about where we are in terms of testing? Because one of the things that I'm reading this morning is that the number of tests being done across the country is actually falling because the testing program is under so much strain.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of testing because there's a lot of cases, because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of virus infecting a lot of people. And that's why we're doing a lot of testing. One of the features of this is that we often find ourselves fighting the last battle. And one of the first battles that we lost, unfortunately, in this pandemic was having good testing in place. You know, that's back in the spring. And having been heavily criticized for that, people have understandably, to an extent, started saying, oh, let's do lots of testing. But, you know, testing is not the target alone. It's testing to prevent infections. It's testing to, in order to stop infections and make the pandemic better. And that's what's necessary, not just the numbers. That means tests have to be done fast. If you hear, as I do sometimes, from contact tracers who have been chasing people, who have managed to find a fraction of the named contacts, get in touch with them and ask them to have a test, and they've already got symptoms, that's really depressing. You need to be doing it quicker. And so it's not only testing, but rapid testing in such a way that we can actually intervene and make a difference.
Mm. And is that the major challenge that we're facing right now around testing in the United States, that the turnaround time just isn't rapid enough?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary challenge. That is the major challenge in the first place is getting the community prevalence to a level where actually, you know, doing these tests is going to make a difference. Because once community prevalence is really high, then contact tracing is not really a particularly good use of the resources because, you know, the number of contact tracers you need increases exponentially. Whereas once you've got it low enough, being able to do these tests really quickly, that's the kind of thing which enables you to maintain it at a relatively low level. So let's take Scotland for an example. Scotland is part of the United Kingdom, but Scotland is pursuing an explicit policy of elimination. They want to make sure the only virus in the country comes from introduced transmission chains. And I've got to say, it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out, given that England and Wales, just to the south, do not have that policy at all. And in fact, I would expect them to be seeing a marked increase in transmission over the next few weeks.
So say more about that. I'm not sure I understand exactly what that means. They're trying to reduce, to limit, you said introduced transmission strains. Did I have that right?
They're trying to get it to the point that the only disease within the country comes from newly introduced transmission events.
I see.
So this is rather like the situation is in, you know, large parts of Taiwan or South Korea and so on. You get to the point where there's so little community transmission, the only thing you have to worry is travelers bringing it in from overseas.
Interesting. All right. Listeners, you can join the conversation on social media. What are you hearing? What are your questions about this new phase of the pandemic? You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio and put your comments there. Dr. Hennage, I want to go to Miami, Florida for sort of a check-in on, I guess, one of the front lines of this battle. Luis Hernandez is the host of WLRN's daily talk show Sundial in Miami, Florida, and he joins us now. Thanks for joining us, Luis. Always good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
Can you give us just a sense of the state of the affairs in Florida with regard to the pandemic? What are we seeing?
What I would tell you is if there were another state or country of comparable size that, you know, wanted to see how not to handle a pandemic, we're your poster child. It's really bad. And it's frustrating because we're waiting to see when we can turn it around. But it's not turning. It's not changing. The numbers have stayed pretty steady in the number of active cases, the number of deaths. We've broken records, you know, week in and week out. I know for the next week or so, we're going to see the numbers skewed a bit because we had a hurricane pass by and we had to shut down a lot of testing. So, you know, the numbers are going to change. And so we're not going to know exactly what happened. But in the hospital, it's funny because the doctor was talking about how hospital rates are not something to look at. And yet South Florida leaders, you know, they depend so much on it. They argue that's the thing they're looking at most. And the capacity rates at our hospitals in the three counties where the numbers are worst in Florida, which is Palm Beach County, Broward County, and Miami-Dade County, capacity is, I mean, it's really, really low. And if there were another surge, then the hospitals would be overwhelmed. And actually, it was 2 days ago, I think a couple of days ago, when the health director in Palm Beach County was speaking with county commissioners about that. And she compared it to the Titanic. She said, that's how bad it is. We're heading toward an iceberg. If we don't do something now, I mean, you're going to use the Titanic as an analogy. It's terrifying.
And Louis, Governor Ron DeSantis, I mean, some people along the way from other parts of the country, and I'm sure in Florida as well, have criticized him for doing too little too late. What's his approach now in terms of, in other words, I'm asking sort of, what is there any kind of a lockdown or a slowdown or what kind of limits are being put on businesses to contain the pandemic in Florida?
No, none at all. There's still a lot of criticism. It when it comes to DeSantis, you know, the governor, it almost seems as if whatever the White House is doing, he's going to follow. And what you see in Florida, South Florida, again, those three counties that I mentioned, is almost a separate state in of itself. And it's always, we've always felt that way. It's become even more apparent during the pandemic because leaders in South Florida are doing this on their own. They are marching to their own tune. As an example, Trump comes out and says, kids got to go back to school. All kids have to be back in school. Shortly after, the governor says kids have to be back in school. South Florida leaders, mayors, but especially the superintendents and the teachers all said, no, it's not going to happen. So there's this split in leadership. And it seems like with DeSantis, whatever we hear out of the White House, he's kind of just repeating. And there's been a push to ask him from, you know, local leaders to state leaders to congressional leaders, have a mask mandate. And he's refused to do so. I'll give you the best example of where this – how this is clashing. This was a few weeks ago where the governor was in Miami and he was sitting at a table at one of the hospitals with the mayor of Miami and some other officials, which, by the way, he was the only person not wearing his mask. But there was a situation here about, now I'm forgetting the word, but basically, going and calling and checking on people who have COVID to figure out, you know, where is it tracers, you know,
yeah, the contact tracing.
Contact tracers. Thank
right,
you. I
yeah.
forgot about it. So we had an issue in Miami-Dade where it's like, well, where are the contact tracers? The mayor had said, well, I'm waiting for the state. And so here we were at a press conference where you had the governor and the mayor, and a reporter had asked the mayor, well, where are the contact tracers? You said the governor has to make that decision. So she turns to the governor. Well, governor, where are those contact tracers? And the governor said, no, Miami-Dade could have always had their contact tracers. And in that moment, the reporter said, governor, you and the mayor are sitting at the table here together. Why don't you solve it right now? And it was the most awkward moment
wow.
to see two politicians. But it shows there's a divide in leadership in how to handle this.
Louis, stand by because Dr. Bill Hannage has been listening in. And Dr. Hannage, I'd love to get your sort of response to what you're hearing, because it seems like this is the issue that we hear about again and again and again, a sort of divide, a lack of kind of coherence, not only at a national level, but Louis is describing a lack of sort of coherent policy at a state level.
Yeah, it's incoherence all the way down. And I have to point out that it's very depressing to hear that, Louis, because it is so true that in any infectious disease emergency, or indeed in any emergency at all, What you need to have is coherent leadership. It's very, very difficult for just ordinary folks to know what to do if they hear one person saying one thing and then another person saying something else. It's natural that they'll be confused. It's natural that they won't understand the messages from public health leaders, especially when they're then contradicted by political leaders. And they will maybe just decide to believe what they want to believe. And that's not helpful, because the fact is that there is a reality. This is a virus transmitted via the respiratory route, which is capable of sickening a very large number of people and include making younger people as well very ill, even if they're less likely to suffer the most severe outcomes. But the people who are older are likely to suffer the most severe outcomes. And then they end up in the hospitals in exactly the situation you described. I just wanted to make one more comment about the hospitalizations.
Sure.
One of the other reasons you see those things in hospitalizations is the kind of people who get hospitalized can change. So early on, it's people who aren't actually that sick who are hospitalized. But as time goes on and resources become less and less and less available, you have to be more and more and more sick to actually get one of those hospital beds, because you're having to try and deal with these scarce resources. And it's truly a challenging thing to deal with a surge. And I wish Florida all the best. And I hope that it will turn around soon. On the other hand, I do think there's a really long road ahead of all of us.
Lewis, one more question before I let you go. You mentioned Governor DeSantis taking his cues from President Trump. President Trump has recently, finally, talked about the importance of wearing a mask. You said DeSantis appeared recently not wearing a mask. Any sense that at least that will change in Florida?
I mean, possibly. You know, if that's the case, that people are going to be following, you know, their political leaders, whatever their party affiliation, then that's, I mean, we were talking about that today in a news meeting. Well, that's good news. If the president's going to at least mention that that's important, then good. We'll start to see more people do it. And that's really the issue, is when at least I mean, I could speak to South Florida, but, when you go around, there are a lot of people who just they don't want to wear it. And some people have pushed back really hard. When Palm Beach County recently had a meeting to mandate mask wearing, there was a large group of people who were yelling and screaming about their constitutional rights. And, and some of it ended up on the talk shows as a joke. But they passed the mandate. Some of the residents sued. They lost in court. Whatever it takes to get people just to even do that, that would be great. Mm-hmm. Now, the governor has started wearing his mask more often, but you'll still catch him at times when he's not. And that's a message. And it's a hard one to get around.
Well, Lewis Hernandez, host of WLRN's daily talk show, The Sundial in Miami, Florida. Lewis, thanks so much for joining us today. It's always good to have you. Really appreciate the update from Florida. And good luck.
Thanks, Anthony.
Yeah, good luck. And Dr. Hanage, I want to introduce Dori Scheimer. She's our producer who has been monitoring our social media feed. Dori, what are folks saying?
Unsurprisingly, people are pretty concerned about what they're hearing so far this hour and what they're experiencing in their own cities and states. And a question that keeps coming up is this question of New York. As we look back to Italy and to Spain and some of these early examples, people are curious how Dr. Hanage thinks New York did. What really, was the quality of their response? And now New York seemingly has a low number of cases. Have they been successful?
Good question. Dr. Hanage, what do you think?
It's a great question. So New York, unquestionably at the start of it, did badly. There were a number of very unhelpful political decisions, and many of them ended up leading to a large problem in nursing homes and, infections among the older population, which at least in part are responsible for the extraordinarily high per capita mortality there. Having said that, eventually the response was strong. It was effective. It managed to lead to a long plateau. This is what we were talking about previously, remember? Dr. Fauci mentioned it as well. We get this kind of plateau. It could have been stronger to cut off that plateau a bit more, but it did bring it down to levels which are now, I would not want to call them manageable, but they are, it is an effort which is worthy of the utmost respect. What we need to do now is to make sure that we get the full benefit from it. And that involves actually sort of getting into that testing, tracing, contact tracing, and being able to maintain this because, this is the summer. I've always thought that the summer would affect it a bit, but not enough to make it go away. We do expect, however, that things will pick up again in the next few months. And we have a winter, we have a fall to look forward to. And so we're going to need to be very, very much on top of this. And that includes New York. Now, there's probably substantial fractions of New York that have some kind of immunity. We don't know what that's going to do, and we're going to have to be watching it very, very closely indeed. It's not a reason to, you know, relax. It is a reason to recognize that what we have learned from New York has come at an immense cost, and nobody in the country should want to repeat it.
All right, that's Dr. Hanage. Stay with us, Doctor. We're going to talk more. We're going to touch down in Italy in the next break. Talk about what happened there and what lessons Italy might offer us here in the United States. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the recent surge of COVID-19 cases all around the world and what we're learning about how to respond to the pandemic. We're talking to Bill Hanage, professor of epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And producer Dori Scheimer is here with one more question from our listeners on social media. Go ahead, Dori.
Sarah asked us on Twitter, can you address how we continue to communicate best practices to people with quarantine fatigue? She says she's heard from people who have justifications for opening up that range from disbelief in the virus to complete misunderstanding of how the virus is transmitted.
What do you think? Go ahead, Bill Hanage.
That's a fantastic question. She's asking it. She's not the only person asking it. I've got at least two or three emails in my inbox this morning, kind of, you know, trying to address exactly the same thing. I think that we need to think about it in different ways. The most fundamental thing about it is clear and consistent public health messaging. You know, we should not be undermining the message of people like, Dr. Fauci. We should not be having this kind of strange, twin track in which Dr. Birx is sort of saying that these states are in the yellow zone and we want to do something now to stop them getting into the red, or these cities need to be looking at themselves very carefully. And then other individuals within the federal government or local government say the opposite. We should privilege public health, and we should try and make it clear to people that, you know, this is something which is helping to save lives. Instead of looking at the numbers of people we are losing or the numbers of infections which are there, we should think about the numbers of infections we are preventing. Think about all of the people who are being able now to live their lives who would not have been able to if we had not put these interventions in place. Now, the other thing about this is that you need to make them sustainable. This is completely true. And that's one of the things which is really important when you talk about the economic piece of this. I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to try and go there in order to give strong prescriptions. But if you're able to find ways to enable companies to perhaps take this as an opportunity to expand their business, to go more online, or to anything which can reduce the number of contacts, and view this as, you know, a dreadful hit that we are taking, but try and find within it some silver lining of opportunities as well.
Dori Scheimer, producer here at On Point, thanks so much for bringing those questions in from our listeners. I want to introduce Sylvia Pagioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's International Desk. She joins us from Rome today. Sylvia, great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, and it's really nice to hear your voice. And Sylvia, we wanted to talk to you because Italy has been sort of one of the standouts for a long time. Of course, it faced a terrible situation early on in this pandemic, but then the country shut down. It bent the curve. If you look at the numbers of infections as they're charted on a graph, it's really quite dramatic. And I'm just wondering, what you observed and what your characterization of what Italy did to get where it is today.
Well, I think the fear of the health concerns was the number one motivation that really got Italians to go against their national character, and which is one of trying to skirt the rules. They're the first to admit this and not be very law-abiding. But believe me, this nation really just got in line and they obeyed. They followed a very, very strict rules for the lockdown, for social distancing. The first, I mean, it was a 2.5 month, very draconian lockdown, where people were, even movements outside of the home were very much restricted. You couldn't go from one region to another unless you had some absolutely, you know, very important reason. But you had to sign self-certification documents justifying whether you're going out to buy groceries or whatever. So it's it was very tough. And essentially, the Italian government listened to the scientists. They had some several advisory committees that, and they followed in line with that. And the Italian and the government essentially put the health of the Italian population ahead of the economy, much to the dismay of many in the business world. And you know, that cost will come down the line because Italy is expected to lose 10% of its GDP this year. But right now, it seems the situation is very much under control, at least for now. The curve has come down tremendously. There are now something like an average 200 maybe new cases a day compared to highs of 6,000 a day in the end of March. And the death rate is very, very low now. It's between 5 and 10 a day, down from a peak of 1,000 one day in the end of March.
You know, Sylvia, I'm really glad you made reference to the national character of the Italians, because I wanted to find a tactful way to ask you about that, because you and I have talked about this over many years. I mean, I adore the Italians. I've spent time there, so I don't want this to come across as critical. But I really was worried that if any sort of nation of people were not going to conform to a lockdown and to a set of rules, it would be the Italians. And yet they did, admirably so. What explains that? Was it the consistent messaging from Prime Minister Conte, or what do you think the key was there?
Whenever I ask anybody this question, I've asked doctors, and basically everybody says fear. Fear of getting sick. And this is the general motivation people tell me. I don't know. I was as surprised as you are, believe me. But I can tell you still today, I mean, now that things are much more relaxed, but, you know, generally speaking, people out, you wear masks indoors, you go into a shop, everybody has a mask. Some people wear them outside, not as many, but depending where situations is, where there's not the possibility to social distancing, you see lots of masks. So there are exceptions. There's been some concern, especially after the everything started being lifted, the movements, everything was looser. There were a lot of young people congregating, happy hours that got everybody scared. But now they've been cracking down, and there's some regions where even the Campania region, where the region around Naples, if you don't wear a mask indoors, you can be fined up to €1,000.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's being observed, generally speaking. The measures are being observed quite strictly still.
Right. So Bill Hannage, who's still with us, what do we learn? What can we learn from Italy? Or do you have more to say about the Italian model?
No, I think the Italian model is really interesting, and I should note that Sylvia probably knows a huge amount more about it than I do, having been there. But it's striking that there was such a large amount of disease early in the spring in the north, in Lombardy, and the very strong restrictions, which, as we were saying, included not traveling between regions without a really good reason, and seemed to have managed to confine the large amounts of disease to that region. And just to, you know, put it in perspective, the total number of deaths per capita in Italy are somewhat north of 500 per million, whereas here in the states of Massachusetts, it's over 1,000 per million. right now. So this just goes to show you what can be done. The other thing that is very interesting, and Sylvia didn't mention it, I've read this, but you can confirm it for me. If you're going to a restaurant, you have to give your name and contact details and stuff, which is very important because it makes it so much easier for contact tracers to be able to get to you if it turns out there has been a transmission event in that restaurant. This is a kind of serious response to the pandemic, which I think would be really helpful to observe and to learn from.
Interesting.
Yes, that's right. There is definitely restaurants. Now, on the other hand, many restaurants have not reopened because not many people are going, and there's this drop in tourism. So, you know, there's certain things like that. But you're right. Absolutely. There's much more contact tracing. You know, Italy also was the first outside of Asia to be hit. They were absolutely unprepared, both you know, in structure and doctors. And, you know, nobody knew this new virus. And now there's a lot more knowledge also. And so, for instance, now you don't have very few patients are in ICUs at this point. There's the so-called special COVID hospitals are empty because, you know, there's a lot more knowledge now about also how to cope, how to deal with this virus. But essentially, I think it's just that the reopening was also very gradual. They started opening a few things, they allowed, and then they waited 2 weeks because that's sort of the time of the contagion that's supposed to, before symptoms emerge. And so it was done extremely slowly. And that's, I think that's another reason why this is, they've been able to keep the numbers so low now. Mm.
Sylvia, I want to ask you one more detail about the Italian response. As you know, I've talked to you about this. My mother was locked down in Italy during the height of the pandemic. She's back in the United States now. One of the things that impressed her that she would talk to me about on a consistent basis was Prime Minister Conte, who, according to her, sort of offered almost a daily talk to Italians. And she described it as consistent, coherent, and everyone sort of understood what the national response was. And it just struck me as such a stark contrast to this country, where there seems to be such a hodgepodge response depending on what part of the country you're in, which state you're in, or whether you're listening to President Trump or Governor Baker or the governor of Florida. Was that your experience, that there was this coherent, consistent response from the top of the government?
I would say so. Yes. The problem was that in Lombardy, which is where the epicenter was, there were some conflicts also for different political parties. So there were some conflicts between the regional government in Lombardy and the central government. But essentially, Prime Minister Conte, who was frankly a rather pale figure before this pandemic, nobody really knew where he came from or what he, who he was, has really emerged as, I would say, as a statesman. He really took control of the situation, and he had good people around him advising him. And through his messaging, and then through the Civil Protection Agency, which had a press conference every night, every day at 6 p.m., and the entire nation would tune in to listen to what the latest numbers were in the situation. And I'd say, yes, there was. And what was interesting is also to do a nationwide lockdown, even though the epicenter was in north in Lombardy. There were southern regions that were unaffected. But the measures were for everybody. So there was a sort of united nationwide application of the lockdown. And I think this also helped. Also, people couldn't move from one area to the other. You have certain regions of southern Italy which have had practically no cases at all.
Mm. Sylvia Pagioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's international desk, speaking to us today from Rome. Sylvia, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
All right. We'll talk soon, again soon. Bill Hanage, listening to Sylvia, I wonder if it's unfair to make the comparison to Italy in this sense. I mean, the United States is much more of a sort of federalist system. It's much bigger. There are 50 states. We have governors. And yet, I can't help but make the comparison to what she described about Prime Minister Conte's sort of consistent, coherent national response, which we seem to have missed. We seem to be missing in this country.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. I would also compare with Germany, which is also a country which has a federal system and which has had, we haven't spoken much about Germany, but it's had a very good pandemic so far. And by the way, Anthony, so far are the two most important words when you're thinking about the pandemic, because we've got a lot ahead of us as well. But thinking specifically of Italy, the lockdown over the entire country had the very great benefit. It succeeded in preventing the large amounts of introductions into other parts of the country and has then reopened cautiously and consistently with a coherent central message. Now, obviously, the United States is a very, very different system, but there is an opportunity. The only central source of a message that we are able to, you know, find in this country would come from the federal government. And it's a really strong message that can come from there, you know. The presidency is a bully pulpit, and people will, including governors in states which at that time did not have very many infections. This could be a message to them, time to get ready for it, because it will come. It's a pandemic. Too many places keep thinking that it's not going to come there. It's going to pass them by. But no, the whole point of something being a pandemic is that it doesn't do that.
Mm. Speaking of the federal government, the White House in particular, of being the bully pulpit. If there was one message that you would like to hear tonight from President Trump, and then again and again and again, to sort of bring the country together around this, what would it be?
I'm going to listen to Tony Fauci, and I'm going to listen to Dr. Birx, and I'm going to do everything in my power to protect you.
Right. I feel like I have to ask this, Bill Hannage, because there's a lot of bad news. It's a lot of grim news. It's disturbing. Is there any good news? Is there anything that gives you hope as you look forward?
I think if I'm honest, the most important message I can find of hope is that I have been overwhelmed by the numbers of ways in which, you know, people, you know, often very ordinary, you know, people who think of themselves as ordinary folks have responded to this in a way which I find truly inspirational. I spoke at our local schools committee last night, and I listened to a lot of the conversations that were going on around there. The sense of community, the sense of outpouring of people eager to help, that's something which makes me feel sort of inspired. I mean, you know, we are living through historic times, and we, you know, our grandchildren are going to be asking us what this was like when they write school projects about it. And when people ask me what was the thing that, you know, gave you hope, I would just say people.
Well, on that hopeful note, which I appreciate so much, I want to say goodbye to Bill Hannage, professor of epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's also a faculty member in the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard. Professor Hannage, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a great pleasure having you.
Thanks, Anthony.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. The program is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amata, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Bradley Noble, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Tim Skoe, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. Thanks for joining us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.